People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Corey Herzog-Fiquette says boredom is a pervasive part of life for people experiencing homelessness. After a decade working frontline roles supporting vulnerable populations, Herzog-Fiquette went for a master's degree. His thesis looked at the connection between boredom and substance use among people experiencing homelessness. It advocated for the importance of addressing boredom as a means of reducing substance use and improving well-being for unhoused populations. On the first half of today's program, I speak with Herzog-Fiquette about boredom, homelessness, and substance use.
So my name's Corey Herzog-Fiquette. I'm of mixed ancestry. My mother's a settler. My father is Inuit Métis from Nunatu'avut in southeastern Labrador. I've been all across kind of Turtle Island, Canada. I was a military brat, so moving around a lot. Ended up kind of settling in Ontario. Went to high school in Kingston, went away for school for a couple of years, ended up back in the area. So share land of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe. So honored to kind of live here and raise my family here. So I've got my master's where it's health promotion, health and rehabilitation sciences. But my thesis is really on boredom, substance use among persons experiencing homelessness. I've got a couple studies pertaining to that as well. I have a bit of lived experience as a youth with episodic homelessness. And I've been working sort of primarily in frontline positions with unhoused youth and mental health and addiction for almost a decade now. And I'm still to this day working for a local community mental health agency. So I'm very, very much entrenched in that type of lifestyle.
Well, thank you very much for making the time to be here virtually. What's the thinking maybe behind taking a look in your thesis and elsewhere at boredom and substance use and homelessness?
Yeah. So I'll be honest with you, a bit of a tangent, but essentially I was working frontline. I was working actually at the time in a crime prevention program with youth, which of course there's a lot of correlation with homelessness and substance use within that demographic. And I remember I had an opportunity to participate in a study, and I did. And as a participant, you had the option to receive the study afterwards. They would email it to you so you could kind of see how your work was being used, right? And I remember when I got it, I read the results, and I'm paraphrasing significantly here, but essentially the premise of the whole article was that people need more than just housing, that the physical house itself, while a great step, is not in and of itself the answer to all these social issues. And I just remember thinking, no duh. Right? Like, this is something that all frontline know. Give me anybody who's worked a couple of years in the field. We know the systemic issues, the constraints, the concerns. But I remember just thinking also, you know, we all know that, but it doesn't really go anywhere, right? It doesn't really go to the policymakers. It doesn't go to the people making the decisions. And that's really when I decided that I wanted to pursue my master's and you know, do some original research to kind of hopefully contribute to some bigger picture solutions, right? Because it's very meaningful to work one-on-one with people, but, you know, especially after a decade in the field, you just see the same issues over and over and over, perpetuating indefinitely, because they're systemic and they're structural. And so that was really the impetus for me to kind of pursue that. And I focus on something that I knew was an issue, but where there wasn't a lot of information on, which is boredom.
Well, how do you define what boredom is in the first place?
I mean, that itself is a million-dollar question. So even academically in the literature, again, really, really interesting, because boredom is universal. Everybody's experienced it. Everybody intuitively sort of knows what it is. But there is no universally agreed upon definition. So different authors give different definitions. For example, one of the longstanding ones is state and trait boredom. So essentially, trait boredom is your own kind of individual propensity to experience boredom, which fluctuates person to person. And state is sort of the environmental considerations contributing to boredom. But there's lots of different definitions. So my preferred one is that it actually has to do with essentially an incongruence or a mismatch between your cognitive abilities, your energy levels, your preferences, and things that are available in the environment, right? And so essentially, it's a lack of meaning, it's a lack of stimulation, it's all of that sort of looped together, and it results in what we call an undirected response, which is essentially just looking for anything to alleviate the state of boredom. And I think it's really, really important that if you've never really thought about it before, boredom is aversive. It's often associated with things like depression, anxiety, and it gets worse over time. So I think fundamentally there is a difference between, you know, you and I, Joe, maybe being bored and take out a smartphone and you're perusing social media for 5 or 10 minutes while you're waiting for a meeting to start. I think that is very, very different than perpetual profound boredom that occurs day after day after day, you know, without meaningful activity to kind of be interjected in there.
So how might this play out for someone who is experiencing homelessness? What are the kind of circumstances that might cause them to experience what we're going to call boredom?
Yeah, yeah. So first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that boredom and homelessness are essentially synonymous. So a lot of studies identify boredom as the, quote, central experience of homelessness. So to be unhoused is to be bored in all intents and purposes. In fact, if you took somebody in a clinical environment, in an environment that you as a scientist have specifically designed to be boring, unhoused people experience the same level of boredom on a day-to-day basis. So just conceptualize that. If you went your best to make an environment boring, that is an unhoused person's baseline. And as far as why that is, I mean, I think then we're really getting into some of those structural determinants. So I think one factor is the lack of autonomy that a lot of people experience as a result of their reliance on institutions to meet their basic needs, right? So shelter environments in the literature, they've been described as very prison-like. They dictate when you can come, when you can go, the rules. There's some literature that would suggest that those environments strive to be boring and devoid of meaningful activity to encourage folks not to use the services. Thereby, you know, I think the premise there is to encourage people to get and secure housing. But I think another big one is just poverty too. The way that kind of middle class and people of means have to alleviate boredom is not really accessible to people who are unhoused generally. You know, you think about going to the movies, costs money. Going to the bar, costs money. Going on trips, vacations, costs money. The zoo, costs money. Everything, right? And so when you have very limited means, the result of that is typically boredom.
Now, how does substance use enter into the picture? We talk about their boredom and homelessness.
You know, I think there's a couple layers to that. I think one of the things that I feel like my research really, really highlighted that was not really expressed previously is that you can really conceptualize homelessness, boredom, and substance use as largely being mutually reinforcing. Right. So they create something of a cyclical pattern. So essentially, you know, we just talked about how when you're unhoused, you tend to be bored. Right. When you're bored, you tend to use substances. Substances is something of almost a cure-all, at least in the short term for boredom. So it can substitute as a source of stimulation when there isn't any in your environment. You know, a lot of times when people are bored, you're ruminating on past traumas. And for those that don't know, people experiencing homelessness tend to have a lot of trauma. So, you know, you're ruminating on it. You're having these negative feelings, negative cognitions. Substances can help mitigate that in the short term. I think when you're unhoused, because of your reliance on those institutions, those meal programs, you're forcibly congregating with other people who are similarly unhoused and experiencing high levels of boredom. And so I think there's a social aspect to it, right? I mean, in one of my studies, one of the participants used a term, it's in your face, right? There's just substances everywhere. You're bored. You have nothing to do. So it helps to kind of facilitate, you know, social connections, which is really important, right? We're social beings. And when you're socially excluded, when you're on the economic margins, you know, it does play a social role. But I think fundamentally, one of the big issues is that substances are just the most affordable means of addressing boredom, right? When you can't invest, when you can't go on trips, when you can't go on vacations, you tend to use substances, right? It's affordable, especially if we talk about, you know, crystal meth, right? Something that is known for being quite cheap relative to a lot of other, you know, recreational pursuits. So I think you have that co-occurring, you know, the stigma, the social exclusion, the economic marginalization. I think it all really contributes to an environment that kind of encourages substance use.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. I'm speaking with Corey Herzog-Vicket, who lives in Kingston, Ontario. His thesis was studying boredom and substance use among people experiencing homelessness. He helped write a review of the literature on that same subject that appears in the current issue of the International Journal on Homelessness. While our conversation today is focusing on the relationship between boredom, substance use, and homelessness, it's not meant to equate those three terms, nor to imply that everyone experiencing homelessness uses drugs. It's also not meant to neglect or minimize other factors that may play into people's substance use, nor to contribute to stigma that impacts people who use substances. Now, if part of our conversation is that there's an idea that boredom is real prevalent in people's experiences of homelessness and is maybe a driver of their substance use, but it's not necessarily something that's incorporated into like policy responses to address those issues, where does that leave us? Like, what are we missing if we're not highlighting the role of boredom in all of this?
Yeah, well, I think, especially from like a service provider and a policy perspective, because I mentioned before, they're mutually reinforcing, and we've got some good studies. And even just anecdotally, if you talk to people, you know, the service users using emergency shelters, things like that, the use of substances, I would argue, tends to prolong the state of homelessness because it negatively impacts the tasks that one needs to complete to exit homelessness. So for example, you know, if people are intoxicated, they're far more likely to be missing appointments with, say, their housing case manager or some other service provider, right? Perhaps they're missing an important meeting with a landlord, or they're not presenting as well as they could. We know that substances, you know, negatively impacts physical and mental health, right? So you have a lot of these additional barriers that are resultant from the use of substances. And so I would argue that if we're not successfully addressing boredom and its relationship with substance use, I think we're actually prolonging homelessness. And I think we're actually inadvertently creating barriers to leaving what is fundamentally a very expensive social service, which is a reliance on emergency shelters, a reliance on emergency medical care, such as emergency rooms, hospitalizations, things of that nature. So while that might not be the intent, I think based on our ignorance and our lack of, you know, strategies to address these environmental considerations, I think we're actually making the problem worse from a big picture perspective.
Well, what could be done to address it then?
Yeah, so that's a tough question. I don't know if there's any one right answer. I think there's a couple of options. If we're talking really big picture, I think addressing poverty, right? Because homelessness is fundamentally a result. It's an outcome of poverty, right? So I think if we look at changing income support systems, so I personally am a big fan of universal basic income. I really like that. I think our current system sort of disincentivizes employment. I think it's really hard for people who are unhoused to be employed, to have that meaningful activity, but also that economic means. So I think we can look really big picture at addressing poverty. And I think that's really big. I think from a more of a municipal perspective, I think we can look at, you know, reducing or waiving the fees for recreational programs and things like that. I've seen some good initiatives locally where, you know, certain recreational facilities are free of charge or heavily discounted. Right. Just giving people an outlet, a place to go, you know, pro-social, social connections. I think within the service providers themselves, so if we look at emergency shelters, I would love to see more initiatives. I've heard of some. I've never actually witnessed them myself, where we're including or incorporating feedback from occupational therapists. Right. Or people that really make a living out of understanding the meaning of occupation, the importance of occupation, the importance of co-occupation, right? Things of that nature. So I think there's multiple levels that need to be looked at. And I know it's hard in this kind of funding environment and the way that we're structured, but I think fundamentally all of those levels need to really work on the same level, on the same page.
Well, what about for someone who has been using substances and has maybe stopped using substances for a time? What is the role of boredom in maybe like people's potential to relapse?
Yeah. It seems to be identified in a lot of the research in virtually every demographic I can think of, from youth to retired veterans to unhoused to pretty much anywhere in between. So I think that that's a really important point. And I'll also mention too, and this is one of the things that we started talking about, was the levels of boredom tend to remain really, really high, actually comparable to the levels of boredom for those who are unhoused when they get housed. So I guess my point there is a long way of saying that just giving people housing itself is not enough to alleviate boredom. Okay. They're just as bored. And I think that boredom does contribute to ongoing substance use, to relapse, and then as a byproxy of that, jeopardize the maintenance of housing. So I think there's definitely more work to be done. But I think boredom plays a really, really big role. And it's not just the experience of boredom. It's also how people alleviate it, right? Like I mentioned, the social connections. So for example, I've known many people anecdotally who have become housed, right? So they've been on the streets for a while. They become housed. They now have this place. They now have this lease. And a lot of times, you know, what do? They bring their friends with them, right? Because to be housed all by yourself with no social connections, right? That's social exclusion. That's isolation. Nobody, again, we're social creatures. We want peers. We want engagement. And so it ends up jeopardizing their own tenancy because now you have eight people residing in a one bedroom unit, right? And unfortunately, those eight people, you know, seven of them are still unhoused, very, very street entrenched, still using substances, tend to bring the substances with them. And that kind of, to your original question, I think encourages or perpetuates that cycle of relapse.
What's the nuance between the idea of people who are experiencing homelessness maybe using substances as a way to cope or temporarily get away from the kind of trauma that they're dealing with and the idea of boredom?
Yeah, well, I think, again, one reinforces the other. So there's also some interesting literature that suggests that the use of substances in and of itself, because it is altering your like neurologically, right? It's contributing to alterations in your brain. And so there's some interesting research that suggests that people that use substances, especially like heavy users of substances, tend to experience more boredom anyway, right? And so the very act of being bored could contribute to the use of substances. And then the use of substances could actually contribute to more boredom in the future. So it really does create this kind of vicious cycle. And I think a lot more research needs to be done on that. But anecdotally, I that matches what I've seen in the field, right? People do have high levels of boredom. You get that co-occurring with other mental health issues, right? Be that ADHD, an increase in impulsivity, personality disorders, emotional regulation, right? I mean, people are complex. But they all sort of mutually reinforce one another, I feel.
So basically, you're suggesting that when people are going through homelessness, they're going to feel more often bored, and that boredom is going to, perhaps through a variety of mechanisms, kind of lead them into substance use. And then substance use is going to make them more bored and also kind of make it harder to do the various things required to get out of homelessness, which are already pretty hard in the first place.
Yeah, no, that's very well put. Yeah, a fancier term, a term that I use, which I believe I got from a Burroughs study, which was an ethnographic piece. Really, really good, if anybody's interested. 2021, I believe. A reification of social marginalization, right? It just further entrenches people, which again, fancy way of saying exactly what you just said.
And you're suggesting that, so like knowing that some of the things we can try to do are maybe like make environments that people need to access when they're homeless less boring somehow?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm not sure there's any one answer, but I would agree with that. I think more meaningful activity. So I actually did a secondary analysis. So for those that don't know, that's essentially me reviewing previous interviews and trying to answer new questions. So question was, what is the perceived relationship between boredom and substance use among persons who are unhoused? That was the research question I was trying to address. And it's really, really interesting because in those interviews, a lot of people mentioned, the desire for meaningful activities. They mentioned other things that they would like to do, be that arts and crafts, be that social recreation. There were lots of expressions of that, but all of them were expressed as, lamenting the fact that they weren't available in their environment. So I think the service users actually have a really good idea of what they would find meaningful, what they'd like to do. And those aren't available. I would also argue too that things like employment supports, very, very important, but historically and empirically, employment supports are not very well geared for that demographic. They don't actually have a high success rate with people experiencing homelessness. So I think we need changes to those employment supports. I hear a lot of lip service about, meeting people where they're at. I hear that term a lot, but I don't see it done very well. And so I think we need to look at those kind of tertiary supports as well. How can we make that meaningful? How can we work with people with disabilities, with acquired brain injuries, struggling with trauma? How can we find ways to get them meaningfully employed? And not necessarily just employment too, but volunteering, giving back to the community, all of those things are valid options as well. That's just one potential solution, but it's just something that I've noticed that we don't do well from a system perspective.
I similarly hear that term, meet people where they're at, all the time. I'm wondering if you can give me a sense of like what you think that actually needs to mean and look like in practice.
Yeah, so I think pragmatically, what you want to do as much as possible is you want to include the service users' opinions. Because as I alluded to before, a lot of them know what they need or what they want, right? Almost nobody, growing up wants to be unhoused. Almost nobody wants to be living in poverty. Nobody wants to be a victim. Nobody wants that for themselves, right? So they're really good at knowing kind of what's missing in their life, what they'd like to see, where they like to be, identifying the barriers that they're facing each and every day. And I think service providers often know that because you're working with those folks and you're having those conversations, but I don't think that trickles up to policymakers necessarily. And I think a lot of times, we're making decisions without really conceptualizing the consequences, right? And so I think as much as possible, we're including and encouraging participant voices, and we're building programs around that. So do with, not for.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Corey Herzog-Fiquette. He lives in Kingston, Ontario, where he works with a local community mental health agency. His master's thesis looked at the relationship between boredom and substance use among people experiencing homelessness. That's the subject of our conversation today. What were you hearing from people who were unhoused about boredom specifically when you were doing this research?
Yeah, just that it's pervasive, just that it's every day, and just that it's unpleasant, right? Again, when people are equating, shelters to jails, when they're saying that there's nothing else to do, when they're saying that it's all they can afford to do, I think it really puts things into perspective, right? Because especially if you're on social media, you hear the dialogue, right? There's a lot of blaming. We still have that kind of mentality of people just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and dig deep and work hard. But Again, you got to think too that, there's structural constraints there. Like, for example, in the city of Kingston, this stat's a few years old, hopefully it's better now, but there's a time where the vacancy rate was 1% or less. Like, there physically is not enough housing. If you're waiting for social housing, at least in this part of Ontario, you tend to be waiting anywhere from 7 to 10 years. 7 to 10 years is a very long time to be pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, right? That's a better part of a decade. So again, we can blame people, but I think it's really, really important that we understand the constraints and the structures there that are encouraging these kinds of behaviors, right? Same with when you're seeing encampments, right? Nobody likes to see encampments in the community. I totally get that. But at the same time, if the alternative to that is an institution that people are likening to a prison being a place that people are forced to go as punishment, that's not really right. You're essentially choosing between two poor choices, right? So I think it's important that people conceptualize all the systemic factors that are encouraging, that rather than just blaming the individual, because nobody wants it for themselves, right?
Well, you've also suggested that idea that even if someone does make it into some kind of social housing, it's difficult to maybe like abandon all the people they have in their lives. And you've suggested that maybe that causes people to have a bunch of their friends over who are also experiencing homelessness. And then that kind of complicates things. Two responses to that situation could be the institutions providing the housing, maybe like making that more difficult and maybe making the institutions feel almost more prison-like, or people's kind of chaotic lives from before spilling into their new house lives. Does that seem like a reasonable thing to say?
Yeah, I think you get a blend of most of those. And of course, there's always exceptions too, right? I don't want to make it seem like, nobody ever moves on and gets housed and is kind of that middle class version of successful. But certainly that's something that I've seen many, many times. And just even personally, I had some episodic incidents of homelessness when I was younger. And I remember a big part of my social relationships for a very, very long time revolved around the use of substances, whether that was, alcohol or cannabis use or, harder, more street drugs, right? But I just remember there was this shared kind of culture of reciprocity, which you don't typically see in other socioeconomic demographics. Actually, I remember once I went to a training and they kind of likened it like, so if you're middle class, and your car breaks down, you get CAA, right? You have a plan for that and they come and they tow your car away. When you're poor and your car breaks down, you need to know a mechanic. Right? That's how you get your car fixed. So the importance on those relationships cannot be overstated because you're using that for survival. And we're talking about it in light of substances, but I think that permeates out, right? You can't just take somebody, put them in a new environment, and expect them to have a completely new social network overnight. That's just not the reality.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today around boredom and homelessness and substance use?
Just that we definitely, we're experiencing an inverse care law. We have been for a while. But just for anybody that's not aware, essentially the inverse care law is the notion that kind of the sickest people in our society have the least access to care, right? And you can look at that in a lot of different social systems. But from a healthcare perspective, people who are unhoused are just the most unwell. They have the highest prevalence of substance use disorder, the highest prevalence of mental health issues generally, the highest prevalence of chronic health issues. They have all of these things against them, and they tend to receive the least amount of care. And especially when we see that demographic continue to increase, right? The numbers of people who are unhoused in Canada, well over 200,000 at this point, they tend to go up every year the past couple of years. I don't see signs of it stopping. So it's going to be an issue that we're going to have, unfortunately, for many years to come. And if people are upset about it, I think we really need to petition and lobby members of the government to come up with long-term sustainable solutions. And I think that's hard in our current political economy. I think that's hard with, you know, election cycles every 4 years, because I think a lot of these solutions create or necessitate long-term planning, which honestly, we're just not great at. But I think we do need to do that. And I think people need to keep in mind that homelessness is expensive, right? So take morality out of it, take ethics out of it. People who are unhoused in Canada cost various levels of the government over $7 billion annually, right? Because shelters are expensive. ER visits are expensive. Emergency service, EMS, is very, very expensive. So we could save a lot of money, just dollars and cents wise, by investing heavily in supportive housing, transitional housing units, rent geared to income units, et cetera, et cetera. Any kind of cost related to the upfront investment will be saved many times over in a reduction on healthcare and things of that nature. So especially as we were seeing, it's not as bad now, but when we're seeing ER departments close, especially during and after the pandemic, right? If we don't want to see that, you know, get people housed, get them connected to family doctors, get them meaningful activities so they're not experiencing boredom. They're not as inclined to use substances. They're not as inclined to you know, be physically unwell. And we'll see the cost savings long-term, but it does take a big picture. So I hope people can kind of get out of the blaming the individual mentality and get into that big picture systemic. Government at all levels has a role to play. And these issues that we're seeing, they're structural and they began matriculating. I mean, homelessness has always been around, but in my opinion, it really started to matriculate in the 1990s with the federal government investing less and less in social housing and RGI housing. And it's taken 30 years to matriculate, but this is a direct result of that. And it's only going to get worse without that kind of investment.
You're not the first person to say that to me about the federal government getting out of the social housing game largely in the 1990s. Briefly, just we've talked about the idea that, like, even just giving someone a room to live in won't necessarily solve issues related to, say, boredom and substance use. If we're talking about big picture, like the solution is to invest in social housing, how do you do that in like a way that incorporates the knowledge of maybe boredom and its impacts as a risk factor of people maybe falling back into substance use or something?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple different things that people need to be mindful of. So one of the things that I used to really like that we don't really see much anymore, and we used to see a lot more scattered site housing, right? So one of the issues when people get housed is they tend to have really low quality of life and really low community integration scores, which essentially means that they're not really connected with those around them, which might be that pull to invite those people that are still street entrenched, right? Because those are their people, those are their connections. So how do we mitigate that? So right now, the way that a lot of governments tend to be doing it is they'll build one kind of social income housing. And it's this big apartment block where you're putting 40, 50, you know, households living in poverty into one block. And you end up kind of inadvertently gentrifying certain areas. But a couple decades ago, they used to have scattered sites. So every time a developer was building, you know, let's say you're building 40 units, well, three of them had to be RGI. So things like that, I think, really help with community integration, with boredom, making sure that we're not gentrifying areas, things of that nature, right? So I think some of it just has to do with planning and poor planning on our part, right? But also some of those other strategies that we talked about, whether that's, you know, municipal fee programs for social recreational opportunities, whether that's including things like occupational therapists or similar sort of occupations within shelter environments to actually work with people on increasing their activities of daily living, their IADLs, right? The knowledge and the tasks and the skills that people are going to need to maintain their housing, right? Because you got to think too, like if somebody has been unhoused for 10 years, right? Or another thing I see quite commonly is somebody is leaving an institution, right? Whether that's a mental health institution or a penitentiary. They may have gone in before the internet was really as big as it is. They may have gone in before phones were a thing, right? So these people are potentially leaving, and then even when they get housing, they're not really sure how to do online banking. They're not sure how to pay their bills. They're not sure how to keep track of a schedule, right? They've been in a survival mode. So that takes a different mindset, a different set of skills that I think a lot of us take for granted, right? Those normative kind of middle class values that we tend to just assume that people have. But we can't make that assumption. People need to know what the expectations are. They need to know how to handle conflicts appropriately, how to keep track of things, right? How to pay bills, how to manage financials, right? How to avoid predatory sort of financial institutions, like some of those payday advances and things of that nature. Those are all traps that I've seen countless people fall into because they don't have the same knowledge, right? If you don't know what compound interest is, how can you successfully manage a credit card debt, right? So just those things that we take for granted, I think we need to incorporate a lot more of that. And that would help people maintain and really truly be successful in their housing.
Corey Herzog-Fiquette works with a community mental health agency in Kingston, Ontario. He's been involved in research around boredom and substance use among people experiencing homelessness. It was the subject of his master's thesis at Western University. A recent review article on the topic that Herzog-Fiquette co-authored appeared in the International Journal on Homelessness.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A chorus of voices spoke in support of bringing more sober supportive housing to Nanaimo. The local city council is advocating for a planned supportive housing building at 250 Terminal Avenue to use what they term a dry housing model. The city held a special Governance and Priorities Committee meeting Monday, June 8th, to hear from community stakeholders on the issue of sober housing. Nanaimo City Councillor Erin Hemmons chaired the meeting. Here she is explaining the context behind it.
Why we are here tonight is in the summer of last year, the mayor wrote on behalf of all of us a request to have the Minister of Housing consider 250 Terminal for dry supportive housing beds. There was some dialogue and exchange with the minister, and in February of this year, we received correspondence that says, I encourage the City of Nanaimo to share any relevant data which may support the request for the designation of 250 Terminal Avenue as dry or sober supportive housing.
Presenters included an addictions medicine doctor, Roger Walmsley, who provided some qualifications on how he thought a sober housing model could be successful.
In my view, the Newcastle proposal provides a bubble of hope with a few qualifications. I think it needs to start small with a few well-chosen clients and build over time. I am curious about the screening process for applicants and the provisions for relapse. Relapse needs to be recognized as an integral part of recovery. And most important is the degree of collaboration and integration with the larger community of citizen groups, peer supports, and healthcare agencies. So even though this is not a treatment-based proposal, it is certainly part of the continuum of care. There is need for sober supportive housing in this community.
Coming up on the program, we'll bring you two personal accounts shared at the meeting related to addiction and housing. Here's Nanaimo resident Charles Myerscough.
As a previously unhoused individual and a former addict, I know better than perhaps anyone else here today how incredibly difficult it is to recover from substance abuse in a wet housing environment. Recovering from drug and alcohol use is difficult enough in a society where we are constantly being bombarded with advertising from the purveyors of alcoholic beverages. For instance, I have had to stop watching sporting events due to the pervasiveness of substance advertising. Drug use has also become prevalent in much of our hit television programming with series like Breaking Bad and Sons of Anarchy. I moved into Newcastle Place about 1 month into my sobriety, and while I could control my own actions, like not viewing programs, staying out of bars, and taking different routes to avoid passing by liquor stores, I was unable to control the actions of other people. I was constantly triggered by the exposure to drugs and alcohol at Newcastle. When I went outside to smoke a cigarette, there would almost always be at least one person who had been using alcohol that day and would need to come up and converse with me. The smell of alcohol would be the first trigger. Often they would talk about a past glory story of alcohol or drug use, a second trigger. They'd be laughing and having a good time and carrying on. That's a third trigger. And they may have an open can of beer on them. That's a fourth trigger. Another major trigger I faced was the smell of substances being smoked. To a non-drug user, the chemical smell created by the smoking of substances, while an irritant, is undecipherable. However, to a drug user or a former drug user, we can tell exactly what kind of drug is being smoked due to the knowledge of what we have used and what we haven't. For instance, I knew exactly when amphetamines were being smoked because that was one of my drugs of choice. In the hallways of the buildings of Newcastle, one could always smell alcohol, whether it be from people currently drinking, spilling their drinks in the hallway, the empty cans piling up in their rooms, and from the alcohol perspiring through their skin. Well, I could avoid this by staying in my room. I would have to stand in the hallway and line up for meal times, and the smell would permeate into the common rooms where events and other activities would take place. I have been asked time and time again how I managed to stay clean and sober housing, and specifically in Newcastle Place, as what I have accomplished is basically unheard of. I am an outlier to the data. So what I did is I attended counseling groups at the adult mental health services on Barron's Road up to six times a week. I volunteered during the federal election. I went to the gym or to the pool a couple of times a week. I literally spent as little time at Newcastle as I possibly could. It was intended to be a home for me and not a place I needed to avoid. There is a serious misconception about the process of recovery amongst much of society. People and many treatment organizations seem to believe that treating the substance use alone will solve the problem. However, in almost every case, there are underlying mental health problems that led to the substance use in the first place. During the period of acute withdrawal, or about the first 3 months, underlying traumas and mental health problems are masked by the effort of acute withdrawal symptoms. It wasn't until I had been clean and sober for about 4 months that counselors at Barron's Road started to discuss my ADHD with me. As a person is also most likely, or one time most likely, to relapse just after the acute withdrawal period, and our current system is sending people who've just finished addiction treatment back into a place where substance use is prevalent, we are denying them the opportunity to even begin the process of professional counseling for their underlying mental health conditions. And to close, I must humbly thank the City Council and the numerous NGOs in Nanaimo for putting the supports in place that we do have. Otherwise, I would not be here today to advocate.
That was Nanaimo resident Charles Myerscough speaking at a June 8th Nanaimo City Council committee meeting on the subject of sober supportive housing. At that same meeting, Wanda LeBlanc shared the story of her journey helping her son through experiences with addiction.
Hi, my name is Wanda LeBlanc. I was a social worker for many, many years, and I'm the parent of an adult child with substance use disorder. He's been in Nanaimo for many years as well, and I volunteer at a shelter in town, and so I've got a pretty good network in terms of supporting him as well as some family. My son at this time, he's in his 30s. A couple of years ago, he wanted to get off the streets. I told him I would help him do that. We tried to get him into detox, and that wasn't readily available. So I got a hotel room and stayed with him for a week and supported him through withdrawal until we could get him into Clearview. He spent the 10 days to 2 weeks in Clearview, and when he was released, he had no housing. And I fought long and hard to get him into something. He was able to get into a shelter and then was able to get into Newcastle. Of course, he relapsed almost immediately in Newcastle because of the exposure to drugs. So recently, my son has tried again, and he has detoxed. He has now spent 6 months in recovery center in Victoria and has been in recovery for that period of time. He will be released at the end of this month, and there is nowhere for him to be released to. He will be able to return to Newcastle. That's his only option. And so, of course, I live with the fear of him relapsing. I think it's a recipe for disaster. He will return to the same people he hung out with, doing the same kinds of things and being exposed to the same drugs. He's one of many, many people this happens to. And I just think it's really important, you know, for us to put a face to these people, and that they, you know, some of them come from, many of them come from good backgrounds, good families, with family supports. It's an incredibly difficult disease to deal with, and they need a lot of support. I advocate for opiate agonist therapy. I think that without it, a lot of people would not be able to live functional lives. So when I hear the word dry housing, I will hope that that will be included as a support. It's, you know, it's always under doctor's care, and it's not street drugs, and it's not high risk. So I just want to put that out there. It's not a question. It's a story. And I hope that we can just really think about these people as vulnerable community members that we should care about.
Thank you so much. I would have allowed a clap there, FYI. That was great. And I also want to note, when I first approached Dr. Walmsley to join us here tonight, he asked, he said, "Aaron, is OAT allowed in this vision?" And it was a yes that got him to this table. So thank you so much for sharing your story.
That was Wanda LeBlanc speaking at a city council committee meeting in Nanaimo on June 8th on the subject of sober supportive housing. At the tail end of the clip, you also heard Nanaimo City Councilor Aaron Hemmons, who was chair of that meeting. Nanaimo City Council unanimously passed a motion to reiterate its call for the planned 50-unit supportive housing building at 250 Terminal Avenue to be dry supportive housing, in the language of the motion. In the audience for the meeting was Nanaimo Gabriola MLA Sheila Malcolmson, who is also BC's Minister for Social Development and Poverty Reduction. I spoke with her following the meeting. Aaron Hemmons was chairing the meeting tonight and suggested that you are supportive of this motion that the council passed and this idea of having 250 Terminal be a sober-oriented supportive housing site. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. It's such a constructive and reasonable proposal that the city's been making for more than a year now. I've been on record with both of the housing ministers, Cowlon and Boyle, advocating for my community. We've added so much supportive housing altogether, in more than 1,000 new affordable housing units that we've opened in Nanaimo since the NDP formed government in 2017. We're at a place absolutely where we can diversify. You know, people need to have options, and I might have had a different answer I might have had a different position on dry housing when we were just opening our first supportive housing units in Nanaimo, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But we're not at that place now. We want people to have choices. I'm very familiar. We hear heartbreaking stories at my office about people that have left treatment and don't have the right kind of place to go. We hear adults with developmental disabilities who need a safe place to live. They don't find it in places where there's criminality and active drug use. We heard heartbreaking stories tonight about senior citizens. We hear this in my office too. For all the reasons raised tonight, I'm in support of 250 Terminal being an option for people who are not in active substance use.
So what do you see as your role or the pathway for this to potentially go from something being talked about at the municipal level to something being enacted by the province?
Yeah. I've been in regular conversations with the housing minister, Christine Boyle. She herself comes from a municipal background. She's very familiar with the kind of conversations that are happening here. She understands my support. And George Anderson, who's the MLA for the north part of Nanaimo, although the housing wouldn't be in his area, he's also in support of the city proposal. And so we're both talking with Minister Boyle, letting her know what we're hearing in community. We exchanged a few text messages tonight, letting her know what I was hearing in the room. I know she and her staff will be very interested to review the transcript and the video recording of the extremely constructive submissions that community members made tonight. And I raised my hands to everybody that took the time to speak. It was a very powerful kind of representation from so many different interests in community about why this is a good idea. And I'll keep encouraging BC Housing and the Housing Minister to make the right decision.
And the site in question is currently home to a transitional housing site. I know there are already there's already the question of, while the permanent building is being constructed, whatever its final form is going to be, where are the people who are living there now going to live? Do you have any idea of the answer to that question?
The Heart and Hearth program that we brought to Nanaimo, where we're taking on housing transition in a different way. You know, originally when we moved people directly from the street right into supportive housing, the transition was poor, and we understand better that people who have been living unhoused for a long time or contending with mental health challenges, that they need often a smaller step, and they need options. That's what Heart and Hearth was intended to do. We've already opened two projects under that umbrella. We wanted to open the former Traveler's Lodge also under that umbrella. That would have been 78 units, which would have been a health-oriented, recovery-oriented, mostly dry, fairly dry, because of commercial challenges with the property owner. That project fell apart, to our great disappointment. To me, that says, you know, we already had built into that, you know, intention that there would be a more Island Health, you know, infused influence on that property. So we'll be looking for an alternative. To me, that means, well, anyway, the intention was there. That project didn't work out. So I'm certainly pushing for an alternative in Nanaimo. The point that you make about not disrupting the lives of the people that are right now living at Newcastle is very fair. We're all concerned with that. And I'm confident that from a planning perspective, we'll be able to make that transition work. The same way that we are with Nikeo up on Labio, and there's going to be some disruption when the city ultimately needs the works yard again. We'll be able to get there from a planning perspective. This push tonight is about making sure that within that continuum, we have a good chunk of dry supportive housing. And if we get that decision then from a planning perspective, I'm confident that the city and BC Housing and the province will be able to move forward together.
So you foresee, even if this new site becomes a sober housing site, and maybe some of the people living now at the transitional site might not fit well in that environment, that they would still be able to find some kind of government supportive housing, and that, well, that the province would work to find them some kind of government-supported housing, even if it's not whatever model the new site takes.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say two things. I mean, one is that that workforce housing at Newcastle that we had to stand up very quickly when we had the court-ordered decampment of the 300-strong tent city down on the port property in 2018, that was always meant to be temporary. And so as we continue to add more housing, we've got a number of affordable housing projects that are underway right now that we're building in Nanaimo. We're always going to be opening up more spaces, as well as when people that are right now living in supportive housing, as they stabilize and are able to move into more conventional affordable housing that doesn't necessarily need all those wraparound supports, always creating vacancies. So it's incumbent on us as a government to be building more housing at every step of the continuum. Shelter housing, the heart and hearth housing, supportive housing, and then just straight affordable housing where people can live more independently. And if we continue to open new facilities, as we have been for 8 years now, over 1,000 in Nanaimo, I'm confident that we'll be able to ultimately deconstruct that temporary workforce housing from 2018 and get people into a better space where they can rebuild their lives in a good way.
Malgamson said she's optimistic about the chances of Nanaimo City Council getting its wish regarding the model for the proposed supportive housing site at 250 Terminal Avenue.
The community's been making very compelling arguments for more than a year now. I am optimistic about very persuasive arguments that have been made and the consensus, again, from a great diversity of service providers and people with lived experience. But it is ultimately the housing minister's decision, and so it's on me to convince her to give a yes to the city's very constructive and very much appreciated proposal.
Minister Malcolmson, thank you so much for your time.
Really appreciate you covering the meeting.
Nanaimo Gabriola, MLA, and BC's Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, Sheila Malcolmson, speaking with me following a June 8th Nanaimo City Council committee meeting that was calling for a sober housing model for a planned supportive housing site in the city. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.